Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So our colleagues at Radiolab did an interesting story, really interesting, on end-of-life care earlier this month. Did you hear it? It turns out the way we treat patients who don't have a lot of time to live is not the treatment that doctors would want for themselves. A recent Johns Hopkins study found 80% of MDs would forego almost all medical care if they lost the ability to decide. No respirators, no feeding tubes, and especially no CPR. So why do most people say the opposite? Well, Radiolab spoke to Dr. Naji Abumrad. Familiar sounding name. He just signed an advanced directive, DNR. That's an order that says, do not resuscitate me if I lose the ability to decide. And, of course, Dr. Abumrad also happens to be the father of Jad Abumrad, host of Radiolab. He and producer Sean Cole are here now to continue a very personal as well as universal conversation. Welcome back to the show, Jad.
Hi.
And Sean.
Thank you so much, Brian.
So, Sean, tell us about the study. What do doctors know about end-of-life care that makes them make certain decisions?
Well, the study was really interesting. It was a longitudinal study that started back in the 50s called the Precursor Study, and it was mainly to figure out the precursors of heart disease. But as the doctors got older and the researchers were asking them more and more questions, this just sort of came out organically through the various questionnaires and follow-up phone calls of how they would want to die. And they basically gave them this scenario saying, if you were brain injured or had a brain disease, you can't really speak intelligibly and you can't recognize people, would you want the following heroic measures done to you if it came down to it, if you had a heart attack or if you, you know, your kidneys failed? And there was a list of them: dialysis, CPR, feeding tube, something even as innocuous as IV hydration. And pretty much all of them, it was a sliding bar graph, but, you know, said, no, we don't want any of that. We don't want CPR, 90% said. We don't want IV hydration, 60% said. What we want is pain medication. We want to be comfortable, and we want to go gently into that good night, basically.
And I wonder if there are doctors listening who want to call right up and talk about the choices you've decided for yourself with advanced directives and what you talk about with your patients. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And your story claims there's a big gap between our perception of CPR's effectiveness in particular and its actual success rate, and you offer kind of a pop culture explanation, so let's take a listen.
There was a study done in 1996 about how many people survive CPR intervention on ER, Chicago Hope, Rescue 911. It's 96. Those are hot shows then. And so the researcher watched all of these medical dramas
and recorded what the result was.
Come on, you can do it. Come back to us, Don. Do it. Come on. 2, 3, 4.
And the answer was 75% of the time, people...
Come on. Okay, get the oxygen. Easy breath.
...were revived.
Come on, nice. Easy breath. Give it to her.
It worked 75% of the time.
Easy breath, Don.
The actual number is more like 8.
8%? Roughly 8% survive to at least a month.
Wow. So George Clooney, incredible doctor. Now that
exactly.
Clip from Radiolab. But seriously, Sean, is TV medicine really shaping judgment, shaping people's unrealistically optimistic decisions in real life?
I mean, I think a case could be made for that, right? Like, I started watching medical dramas when I was a little kid, and, you know, truth is television when you're a kid, and that sort of sticks with you. And, you know, it's just our popular conception, whether it's TV, movies, or just, you know, what we talk about at the water cooler, like, oh, no, it's of course it's going to work, as long as I learn it, right? If I'm trained, maybe I should be trained so I could save this bystander. What we don't know is that you're bound to break somebody's ribs if you give them CPR. And that, yeah, that 8% is an interesting number because those are the people that make it to the hospital. The people that have what we would call a good outcome, that's more like 3%. And then 3% are brain addled, and another 2%, I think, are brain dead. I haven't looked at the
study.
You
really get into difficult decisions for individuals. Would you take a 3% chance of a positive outcome with a broken rib for the broken ribs for the chance of survival, or would you offer an advance directive against that kind of treatment? And those are the fraught decisions that people have to make. But Jed, this story was personal for you. You're the subject as much as the journalist. I want our listeners to hear some of the conversation included in this piece that you had with your father about his advance directive, DNR, do not resuscitate, if his heart were to stop. And in it, this also details the other treatments he wouldn't want to prolong his life with. Let's listen to the moment in your piece where he's explaining this to you.
It sounds like, why wouldn't you want artificially provided food, intravenous fluids, or other nourishment?
That's my choice.
I know, but that doesn't sound like it's that much of an intervention, really.
It is an intervention to sustain life unnecessarily. If I should ever have a terminal condition,
would you want CPR done?
If I have a choice, the answer is no.
So, Jad, did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did. The whole fact that I was having that conversation surprised me. I mean, one of the strange coincidences of this story was that Sean had been reporting it for a while, and then I visited my dad, and at dinner one night, he sat me down and said, I have something I need to tell you. And he laid out this advance directive. And I had not told him we were doing this story. It just somehow came up.
Wow.
And
synchronicity.
He conformed to everything that Sean was finding out when he spoke with doctors. My dad basically wants nothing done when he is at that final stage.
And do you think his career as a physician informed this choice?
Oh, certainly. He feels a sense of futility about some of the treatments that doctors generally offer at the end of life. It's a very difficult thing, he says, to have that conversation and how to have that conversation in a way where you're not – certainly not putting undue pressure. You're not coercing the patient. You're respectful of the fact that there might be family members who need to say goodbye. But it's also a sense that doctors know the repercussions of something like CPR or intubating someone. Even antibiotics, that was one of the funny things that Sean discovered. I mean, that's something that seems harmless, but – 90 or 80% of doctors, I'm sure I got that number wrong, say they wouldn't even want that. So there's a way in which they know things that we don't.
But why not in that case? What's the downside of being treated with an antibiotic if it's going to prolong your life?
It'll prolong your life. That's the downside.
Because if they're already terminal, if they're already unable to communicate, and this is the condition that we're starting with as the premise.
That's right.
Then they don't want anything.
That's right. And a couple of doctors that I talked to at this vascular health conference that I went to here in Manhattan, many of them were like, IV, okay. And then a couple of them, I interviewed two at a time, and one was like, IV, no. And the other one turned to him, his colleague, and said, not IV? And he's like, dude, IV, like, you'll last another 3-4 days maybe. In that state, do you want to last another 3-4 days?
Sally in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for calling.
So I'm actually a physician who specializes in end-of-life care and palliative care, and I think that one of the reasons why these discussions don't happen the way that we would want is a lot of times these conversations are between families in crisis and doctors in training, residents, you know, fellows, who are oftentimes exhausted, they don't know all the facts, and so it becomes a very, I just don't think that the conversation goes the way it should. I think that sometimes there is almost a threat of physical abuse, like, do you want me to break your ribs? Do you really want me to torture you? Instead of a conversation about the facts, that's what it ends up being. And so I think that's one of the reasons why people make the wrong choices, is that the conversation doesn't happen the way it should.
Sally, do you think that sometimes doctors do continue care because they're worried about getting sued if they don't, quote, try everything, or maybe they have a financial incentive to continue ordering tests or treatments beyond reasonable hope, or, you know, those are the big two that always come up, or is that too cynical?
I think that financial was not very common. I would say that's rare. But I do think that the worry that they're going to get sued or that they're going to get in trouble, I do think that is kind of a thing that we live with when we practice medicine these days, because mm-hmm. it's it seems like it's harder to get sued for if you try to prolong life, even if that life is a horrible, uncomfortable life.
Sally, thank you very much for your call. I wonder if there's another reason, too, and I should really look for another doc. Well, in fact, why don't I just go right to Doug in Somerset County. Doug, thank you very much for calling in. You're a doctor, too, right?
I am. I'm a family practitioner, and I usually always speak to my patients and family members about end-of-life terms. It's, as your previous caller stated, we have to be very careful. It's one conversation that you have with the family, and I really very carefully try to make the conversation, what would your loved one have wanted, not what do you want or what do you think your loved one wanted, but what did your loved one want, and put yourself in the place of the loved one who was suffering. And I'm a pretty strong advocate that we really should stop suffering and stop the poor quality of life that we frequently maintain.
But could people feel pressured by that to end their lives? I mean, judging from you and the previous caller, doctors are afraid of falling off the cliff on either side of this, either being too aggressive and recommending that patients not be treated near the end of their lives, or in recommending that they do.
Well, I think it's equality. I think you have to look at mom and dad and say, this isn't the quality that they want or they deserve. And what would they have wanted at this point in time? Mm-hmm. I try not to make it pressure laden. It's tremendously an emotional minefield for all of us that are in it, families and non-families, as family members as well. It's a very difficult time, and I think the choice is, what would that person who was suffering have chosen when they were well?
Right. Do you ever get the sense that people make choices to continue end-of-life treatment or treatment near the end of life because of something they've seen on television or that's around in the popular culture, like a false success rate of CPR?
Yes. Yeah, they'll think that if we can get one more dialysis, she'll be better. If we can get another round of antibiotics, they'll get over this. If I can just take them home, they'll do fine.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of that.
Go ahead,
yeah,
John.
Doug, can I ask you a question? Does the conversation ever with your patients come around to, Doc, what would you do if this was your mother or this was your father?
Frequently.
It does.
Frequently. And I interject dignity.
Uh-huh. And
I interject what kind of dignity would your parents want and do you want for your loved one?
Because that's something that we heard both from Jed's dad and also from a couple of other doctors, that actually allows a bridge, over that gap between doctors and patients, where it's like the doctors would say, and maybe you say this to your patients, if it were a personal decision for me, like it's a personal decision for you, this is what I would do, and it allows them to actually, you know, as opposed to saying this is what I would do for my body, this is what I would do for my loved one.
Doug, thank you very much for your call. I wonder if doctors, Jad, look at each individual procedure and see it as something with a reasonable chance of success. You know, maybe they don't want to tell a family that once you begin ICU medicine, the chance of having the old Mary back mm-hmm. gets slimmer and slimmer with each procedure, or they have a certain confidence in their ability to do the next individual procedure as well as it can possibly be done, and so maybe we should take that chance.
Yeah. Well, I see it as perhaps – I mean, well, I'll say this. One of the things we heard over and over again is that families will often find themselves in these situations where they haven't had the conversation. They haven't had the conversation I had with my dad. I didn't want to have that conversation, but he sort of prompted it. And so you're there. Your loved one is incapacitated. They can't communicate. And there's just a question then, what do you do? We heard over and over again that oftentimes family members will disagree. You know, there'll be an estranged family member who will swoop in, and perhaps they're carrying a lot of guilt and they're not ready to say goodbye, and they won't agree to let that person go, whereas another person in the family will. And so you have a lot of disagreements at
sure,
that point.
Absolutely.
And it's a very difficult thing for a doctor to navigate.
It is just another piece of this ongoing conversation that we've had here in many pieces on this show and will continue to, and as you've done so brilliantly on Radiolab, and I know you're getting a ton of comments I don't know if we can end a segment like this on a lighter note, but somebody tweeted us, just heard on Brian Lehrer that on TV, medical, 75% do survive after CPR. In real life, it's 7%. The takeaway is try to have your heart attacks on TV.
Well said.
People should go to radiolab.org to hear this piece.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the latest podcast. You see it right there on the homepage.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.